This is Scott Becker with Becker's Healthcare. I'm thrilled today to have a conversation about mental health in the United States with John Broderick. John Broderick is the Senior Director of Dartmouth Hitchcock Healthcare. He's the Senior Director of External Affairs. We're going to talk today about mental health in the United States, how he got so involved in mental health, and also sort of mental health in the age of coronavirus. John, give us a moment and do a better job with the introduction than I did, please.
No, you did fine, Scott. I am currently the Senior Director of External Affairs at Dartmouth Hitchcock, and that's in New Hampshire, and just off the campus, actually, of Dartmouth College. And prior to taking that job, I was Dean of the Law School at the University of New Hampshire, and prior to that, I was Chief Justice of our Supreme Court here in New Hampshire.
So that is a heck of a career. That's unbelievable. So Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, you served as Dean of the Law School, and now you're serving as Senior Director of External Affairs for Dartmouth Hitchcock. That's an amazing career. Take a moment and talk to us about how you came to be so involved in mental health and some of your thoughts on what's going on in mental health in the United States.
Be happy to. The work I've been doing for the last several years that Dartmouth Hitchcock has so supported is the most important work I've done, Scott, in my entire life, and I don't say that lightly. I had mental health issues in my own family. My wife and I didn't see them. In our oldest son, we had two sons, and mental health issues started to afflict him when he was 13, and he didn't know what it was, and we're baby boomers, so we never saw it for what it was. And then it migrated to alcohol misuse. He got a master's degree in the middle of all that, which is just remarkable. But the alcohol problems got worse over time. We were told he was an alcoholic, and we were told to act accordingly. And so we made choices, well-intended but wrong, with my son that eventually led to him assaulting me, him going to the state prison in New Hampshire, and me going to the ICU unit at a local hospital, and it became a national story. And I see it now for what it was. Our family is healed. We harmed my son, I think, unintentionally, but we did because we didn't see it. And he's taught me a lot about mental health. And then I had the good fortune to get involved in this campaign, and it has changed me. It's opened my eyes.
And John, you had mentioned in that discussion of sort of the family situation that you and your spouse had made some wrong choices. Help me understand what those wrong choices were, because that's always interesting when somebody can understand, we did this, but that's not what we should have done, and we should have done that. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, for much of his younger life, through college certainly, he started drinking in college, and so we saw drinking, and we tried to counsel him on that. And it got worse over time. He got a graduate degree in Boston, a master's degree. His drinking was pretty prominent, but somehow he got through. And he couldn't hold jobs after his graduate degree because we thought of his drinking. And finally, we reached out to the alcohol experts, and they said, your son's an alcoholic. He was living with us at the time. And they said, you have two choices. You can either put him out, hope he hits bottom and turns his life around, or you can let him stay in your house and he's going to die drinking in your house. And up to that point, Scott, as unimaginable as it seems, no doctor, no neighbor, no friend, no family member, and sadly not us, ever said, I wonder if he could have a mental health problem. And so we put my son out, and everything went south from there. And I see it now, and we made mistakes. It was all over the papers and the national press when this happened years ago. But I didn't do anything about it because I was ashamed of mental illness and ashamed of my own ignorance about it. But about 5 years ago, I got involved in this Change Direction campaign, which was the brainchild of a psychologist in Maryland, Barbara Van Dalen. And then Dartmouth Hitchcock was my biggest supporter. I can't tell you how much that meant. They gave me a third of the money for it before I even joined them. And then they asked me to join them, and they have been the wind beneath my wings on this campaign for the last 3 years. And I have now spoken to 110,000 people, 80,000 of whom are school kids, 7th grade through 12th grade. I have hugged so many kids, Scott, with wet eyes and cracking voices who come up to me and thank me for sticking up for kids like them or thanking me for doing what I'm doing.
And talk to me for a moment, just for a moment more about this. The traditional concept of AA and then Al-Anon is sort of loving detachment, that sort of at some point you have to decide, I love the child, I love the spouse, I love whoever it is, but I need to let them go, because if not, yes, it will have a horrendous codependence on the rest of us, and they have to ultimately decide they want to get better. And what you're saying is, look, it wasn't just addictive behavior, Alcoholics Anonymous type of stuff. It was deeper than that. It was mental health issues that perhaps led to the inability to control alcohol or the addiction there. Talk a moment about that.
There are a lot of co-occurring problems that we have seen in separate silos for generations. And not everyone, by the way, who has a mental health problem is going to abuse drugs or alcohol. So I don't want to leave that misimpression. But a number of them do. And so we see it for behavior. We don't see it for cause. The Attorney General of my state, who's been a great ally in this campaign, said to me not long ago, John, I see mental illness 24/7 in my job as Attorney General. Sometimes it's a drug overdose. Sometimes it's domestic violence. Sometimes it's abuse and neglect of a child. But we call the behavior. We don't look for the cause. And most people, by the way, with a mental health problem are successful, decent, honorable people who are suffering in silence. And they are ashamed of their illness because all of us, God, have taught them that. So my efforts have been to demythologize it, to talk about it, to normalize it. And if we do that, we will then see that mental health issues affect so many of our friends and neighbors and our colleagues. And we will then say, we don't have a system. Why is that? And we'll start to build one. That's my goal.
And what does that look like? What does starting to build a mental health system look like? I know that currently huge shortages of psychiatrists in the country, and I know that's just one small part of the problem because there's so many different levels of health providers that provide help to people with mental health and behavioral health issues. But what does a mental health system look like? What does a more complex system look like?
We need more psychiatrists for sure, and we need to compensate them well. We don't, by the way. They're among the lowest paid people in the medical profession. I didn't know that, but I know it now. We need to have more mental health workers. We need more counselors. We need more counselors in our schools. We need better insurance coverage. We don't have parity. You know that, too. Even though the law says that we don't. So people with mental health problems are not treated in the same way by the health system as people with bad backs or heart disease. And that's on all of us.
You know, 100%. You served as dean of the law school, chief justice of the Supreme Court. Those are, I am a lawyer by background and sort of recognize the sort of high level of those positions or the importance of those positions. What did you learn about mental health in sort of that world that you were in prior to this? And how much did you see of it besides your son's own situation? We talked to the Attorney General, and he says he sees it every single day, which all of us do today. Now that our eyes are open to it, we see it all the time in everything. But what did you see when you were in those roles, either with students or with lawyers?
When I went to law school 100 years ago, everyone had perfect mental health, if you know what I mean, because nobody ever talked about it. And so as a lawyer, I'm sure I saw it. I didn't realize that I might have seen the effects of it. I might have seen drinking, which was sadly not totally uncommon in the legal world. I might have suspected someone of drug use, but I had no appreciation of mental illness at all. And when my family's tragedy arose, my eyes started to open and I started to see it. And it's many, many places, Scott. Most people don't realize what I'm about to tell you. I didn't realize it either. The largest providers of mental health services in our country are jails and prisons. That doesn't seem like a good model to me, and that's a result of our genuine ignorance and reluctance and fear to deal with it. And I will tell you, listeners, this as well, and I've learned this over the last 4 years with Dartmouth Hitchcock support. The amount of anxiety and depression among young people at grade 7 to 12 is epidemic. epidemic in America, and that's true around the globe, and we're not really dealing with it. We ask schools to do it, and they can't by themselves do it. We need community engagement, and we need to build a system without shame or shadows.
And why is that, that you had just mentioned that I think in grade 7 to 12, mental health issues, depression, other issues are sort of at an all-time high or skyrocketing, and we all have different theories on why that is. The world seems so much more complex than it used to be, a million different reasons. But what are you, any theories on why that is and why it's so much more widespread today?
Let me share my thought on that. And it's not medical, but it's kind of experiential and anecdotal. I grew up as a baby boomer. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have a lot of the gadgets we have today. And thank God we have them. Believe me, I'm not an anti-tech guy. But I had a life that moved at a slower pace, that had fewer expectations. Every house in my neighborhood had a one-car garage. We had dinners with my family, my sister, my mother and father, myself, pretty much every night. I spent a lot of my childhood ages, you know, 5 through 12, with the inefficient use of time, unsupervised play. I had friends. I knew all my neighbors. I'd been in their houses. My family knew them. I was enveloped emotionally by something safe and secure, and I had no memories of 9/11 because that didn't happen yet. I didn't have school shootings that I worried about. This generation of young people that I'm talking to were all born after 9/11. They don't have the memories I have. They don't have the visuals I have. And the world is moving at a pace where these kids need to be safe and secure. And if you or your listeners, Scott, were with me with some of those conversations I have, these kids would be crying to me, saying I have so many expectations on my back, or I'm scared of school shootings, or I don't have time with my parents, or I could never tell my parents what I'm telling you. It's not rocket science. We do not have the emotional stability for young people that I grew up with. That's generically true.
And so a lot of it is the expectations on people today, the speed at which society moves, the complexity of everything, and sort of the lack of grounding and sort of that daily unit or whatever you might call it, daily friend group, daily family group that sort of envelops you in comfort. It sort of helps support that emotional situation.
And parents, by the way, and parents love their kids, don't get me wrong, but every time I go to a school, I say, how are the parents here? Are they involved in the school? Some of them are, but most of them aren't. They just don't have time. It's different. And some of it is an advantage, obviously. These kids are smarter than I ever was, more informed than I ever was. But they're also more fragile. You know, Scott, in the last couple of weeks, maybe the last month, the Center for Disease Control released these statistics, which should alarm all of us. I see it, by the way. From 2007 to 2017, the rate of suicide among people from ages 10 to 24 increased 56%. Are we okay with that? If you look at the youth risk behavioral surveys, and they do them in most school districts around the country, you'll find almost a quarter or more of the students are depressed. 18% are engaging in non-lethal self-harm, and about 15% are giving serious thought to suicide. And some smaller percentage, 2, 3, 4%, are attempting to kill themselves. I mean, that wasn't my life growing up, even though we didn't talk about it. It wasn't like that. And it is like that now, and it's no one's fault. It's just we're not taking the time to stop and study it without shame or blame and dealing with it. That's what I see. A lot of it rests with the community. A lot of the social emotional growth I'm talking about rests in communities.
That's actually an amazingly frightening stat. And we all know it sort of anecdotally by knowing of people or kids in the area or kids through our children's situations or other situations who have committed suicide. So we're all anecdotally familiar with this. And it's so scary.
Whatever the stereotype is people might have in their mind, for kids with mental health problems. Let me break it this way. I spoke at a private school recently to 280 kids. I stayed after I spoke for another hour, not because I chose to, but because kids come up to you. And I have young boys coming up, high school age kids, and they're hugging me with wet eyes. And the counselor said to me afterwards, "I've never seen that." I said, "Oh, I see it all the time. It's not me, it's this topic." She said, "Three of those boys you were hugging, two of them were stars on our hockey team, and the other is the star of the basketball team." I said, "Not when they were hugging me, they weren't. They were frightened."
Right.
That's what we're dealing with. That's the call I'm trying to give people. We need to start facing it and dealing with it, and we can. Well, we can ignore it and keep reading about drug overdoses and suicides. I'm tired of doing that.
Yeah, no, there's so much of it, and it is so scary. And you're right. It's you know, you wouldn't know from somebody's social media life that anything's wrong, because it appears these kids are stars, are doing fine, they look like they're accepted by their peers, everything, and so forth. And just scary situation, and there's so much of it.
Well, you know, one of the things with this coronavirus, as horrendous as it is, and the suffering that's going on in America, I think all of us are starting to realize that loneliness, isolation, can really get us in a bad place. So, in a sense, the only silver lining in all this is we realize that mental health problems can affect us too. Maybe not to the level of some, but we all realize it. And I think young people are starting to realize, as clever as they are and as cyber efficient as they can be, being with your friends, physically being with your friends, really does matter. And I've seen families outside walking. I've seen kids, obviously, in the same family outside playing in the yards. I hadn't seen that recently. And it makes me realize that that's important. And maybe people are starting to see that. But the social fabric has been torn by social media. It's been improved and enhanced in many ways. But I talked to a pediatrician recently, and I said, "What's the difference between kids and parents today versus 27 years ago?" He said, "Well, let me answer it this way. Kids don't look in the eye anymore. And parents come into my examining room more frequently because they're worried about their child being sexually molested, which is a good thing. But," he said, "they don't look up. They're on their iPhones. They don't talk to me. They don't ask questions." That was never true when I started to practice. So the world has changed, and some of it's great, and some of it on a social-emotional level is devastating.
I mean, 100%. And it's so interestingly true about the silver lining you mentioned. It's and just as an example, we have a college-age kid who I never thought would be home again for 6-8 months nonstop right now. And now she's home every day. And you know, there are a lot more walks and a lot more family dinners than I think there ever were. It's a fascinating sort of silver lining in that you mentioned. John, let me ask you one final question.
Sure,
go ahead, please.
No, you go ahead. I was just saying, I hope, Scott, that what we are seeing and experiencing as it relates to more social contact, we don't forget about when the sun comes out again. And my plea to people across this country is to stop and listen to your children. Don't worry what the answer is. Listen to them. Talk to your kids. They talk to me, Scott. I had a football player crying one day after I spoke. He came up, and he had mental health issues. He told me what they were. And I said, "Have you told your parents?" This big football player. He said, "Oh, I could never tell my parents." Why is that?
And what's the advice for parents? Because one of the challenges, of course, that we have, or at least I have, is, you know, one of my kids will start explaining an issue to me, and I will naturally, in the way that I can't help myself, start jumping to solutions.
Yes, exactly. that's a malady for all parents, especially if you're a lawyer, as you are, or we're in the business of solving problems. And to be an attentive listener, to really find out how your kids are doing, to see if they seem anxious or withdrawn. My son was an artist, you know, is an artist, but when he was younger, he was, and he spent a lot of time in his room with his door closed, drawing, and he was actually withdrawing. And so if your kids are sad for an extended period of time, all of us are sad occasionally, but if it extends for days and weeks, or if their hygiene is different, or they're not engaging with their friends as they used to, we have to be open to it, and we have to talk to our children. There is no shame and no blame in mental health. I see that now. And I say it as someone who is exquisitely ignorant, who made bad calls, who harmed his own son unintentionally, and almost destroyed our family. But we're back. And now I'm trying to pay it forward in a way. And I see, Scott, what I never saw. And if we continue to ignore it, as we have generationally, we'll have another generation of kids who'll have more kids with problems. 1 in 5 adolescents by the age of 14 has a mental health problem. 2/3 have one by age 23. Last year in our country, more than 47,000 people took their own lives. Oh, we lose a veteran to suicide, Scott, every 90 minutes. These are brave, tough people, but we, society, has told them over time that a mental health is a weakness, it's a character flaw. It's none of those things. None of those things.
Give me that stat again, John. How many people a year commit suicide in our country?
47,000.
Got it. And you think about the effort we're putting into COVID-19, and rightfully so, not to comment negatively positive on that, but you look at this issue, and it will certainly kill, probably around the same amount of people every single year, and we have to figure out a way to put the right level of effort and family dynamics and everything else into that as well.
It's true, Sean, all around us. By the way, last year, and for many years before last year, more police officers and first responders in America died by suicide than every other cause in the line of duty. We don't talk about that. Why is that? What are we afraid of? What are we waiting for? There's no shame in it. Most of the mental health problems I've learned from the professionals are successfully treated. And most people with a mental health problem, by the way, are raising families, going to school, holding a job, coaching your kids. They're not bad people, not defective. They're just dealing with a health issue that you're usually afraid to talk about.
Well, and the reality is, all of us have mental health issues. It's just a matter of degree.
Absolutely. But we treat it like it's a one-off problem. Or if we see it, we're afraid of it. And we just got to start to embrace people. I have hugged hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of kids in 4 states because of DH and their help for this campaign over the last 45 months. It changes you, Scott. I see what I didn't see. I know these kids aren't getting help. Only about 1 out of 2 kids that I'm hugging are seeing anybody for counseling or advice.
Well, just a fascinating, fascinating discussion today, John. I could talk to you for hours. What a breadth of experience. What a fascinating situation. I thank you, and I thank Dartmouth Healthcare, Hitchcock Healthcare, for having you in the role you're in and doing what you do. Just fabulous, John. We'll try and get you on again to talk more about these issues, because there's just so much to talk about.
I would welcome it. We need to start a national conversation that will change and save lives, Scott, when we do.
Well, just fantastic. John, I appreciate your time so much. Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, thanks very much, Scott.